doctor, who only converses on subjects that he knows nothing about. If you scan the lines, I think you will agree with me that he has vanished. I read the page with growing consternation. The name of Quaverley did ring a bell, but of his short paragraph there appeared to be no sign. He doesn't appear later? No, officer. My student and I have been through it several times. There is no doubt about it. Mr. Quaverley has inexplicably been excised from the book. It is as if he had never been written. Could it be a printing error? I asked, with a growing sense of unease. On the contrary, I have checked 7 different copies, and they all read exactly the same. Mr. Quaverley is no longer with us. It doesn't seem possible, I murmured. I agree. I felt uneasy about the whole thing, and several links between Hades, Jack Shit, and the Chuzzlewit manuscript started to form in unpleasant ways in my mind. The phone rang. It was Victor. He was at the morgue and requested me to come over straight away. They had discovered a body. "What's this to do with me?" I asked him. As Victor spoke, I looked over at Dr. Spoon, who was staring at a food stain he had discovered on his tie. "No, on the contrary," I replied slowly. "Considering what has just happened here, I don't think that sounds odd at all." The morgue was an old Victorian building that was badly in need of refurbishment. The interior was musty and smelt of formaldehyde and damp. The employees looked unhealthy and shuffled around the confines of the small building in a funereal manner. The standard joke about Swindon's morgue was that the corpses were the ones with all the charisma. This rule was especially correct when it came to Mr. Rumplunkett, the head pathologist. He was a lugubrious-looking man, with heavy jowls and eyebrows like thatch. I found him and Victor in the pathology lab. Mr. Rumplunkett didn't acknowledge my entrance, but just continued to speak into a microphone hanging from the ceiling, his monotonous voice sounding like a low hum in the tiled room. He had been known to send his transcribers to sleep on quite a few occasions. He even had difficulty staying awake himself when practicing speeches to the forensic pathologist's annual dinner dance. "I have in front of me a male European, aged about 40, with grey hair and poor dentition. He is approximately 5'8" tall and dressed in an outfit that I would describe as Victorian." As well as Bowden and Victor, there were 2 homicide detectives present, the ones who had interviewed us the night before. They looked surly and bored, and glared at the Literatech contingent suspiciously. "Morning, Thursday," said Victor cheerfully. "Remember the Studebaker belonging to Archer's killer?" I nodded. "Well, our friends in homicide found this body in the boot."
"Do we have an ID?"
"Not so far. Have a look at this."
He pointed to a stainless steel tray containing the corpse's possessions. I sorted through the small collection. There was half a pencil, an unpaid bill for starching collars, and a letter from his mother, dated 5 June 1843. "Can we speak in private?" I said. Victor led me into the corridor. "It's Mr. Quaverley," I explained.
"Who?"
I repeated what Dr. Spoon had told me. Victor did not seem surprised in the least.
"I thought he looked like a book person," he said at length.
"You mean this has happened before?"
"Did you ever read The Taming of the Shrew?"
"Of course."
"Well, you know the drunken tinker in the introduction who is made to think he is a lord and whom they put the play on for?"
"Sure," I replied. "His name was Christopher Sly. He has a few lines at the end of Act One, and that is the last we hear of him." My voice trailed off.
"Exactly," said Victor. 6 years ago, an uneducated drunk who spoke only Elizabethan English was found wandering in a confused state just outside Warwick. He said that his name was Christopher Sly, demanded a drink, and was very keen to see how the play turned out. I managed to question him for half an hour, and in that time he convinced me that he was the genuine article.
Yet he never came to the realization that he was no longer in his own play.
Where is he now?
Nobody knows. He was taken for questioning by two unspecified spec ops agents soon after I spoke to him. I tried to find out what happened, but you know how secretive spec ops can be.
I thought about my time up at Haworth when I was a small girl. What about the other way?
Victor looked at me sharply. What do you mean?
Have you ever heard of anyone jumping in the other direction?
Victor looked at the floor and rubbed his nose. That's pretty radical, Thursday.
But do you think it's possible?
Keep this under your hat, Thursday, but I'm beginning to think that it is. The barriers between reality and fiction are softer than we think, a bit like a frozen lake. Hundreds of people can walk across it, but then one evening a thin spot develops and someone falls through. The hole is frozen over by the following morning. Have you read Dickens' Dombey and Son?
Sure.
Remember Mr. Glubb?
The Brighton fisherman?
Correct. Dombey was finished in 1848 and was reviewed extensively with a list of characters in 1851. In that review, Mr. Glubb was not mentioned.
An oversight?
Perhaps. In 1926, a collector of antiquarian books named Redmond Bulge vanished while reading Dombey and Son. The incident was widely reported in the press owing to the fact that his assistant had been convinced he saw Bulge melt into smoke.
And Bulge fits Glubb's description?
Almost exactly. Bulge specialised in collecting stories about the sea, and Glubb specialises in telling tales of precisely that. Even Bulge's name, spelt backwards, reads E-Glubb, a close enough approximation to Glubb to make us think he made it up himself. He sighed. I suppose you think that's incredible.
Not at all, I replied, thinking of my own experiences with Rochester. But are you absolutely sure he fell into Dombey and Son?
What do you mean?
He could have made the jump by choice. He might have preferred it, and stayed.
Victor looked at me strangely. He hadn't dared tell anyone about his theories for fear of being ostracised, but here was a respected London literatech nearly half his age, going farther than even he had imagined. A thought crossed his mind. You've done it, haven't you?
I looked him straight in the eye. For this we could both be pensioned off. Once, I whispered, when I was a very young girl, I don't think I could do it again. For many years I thought even that was a hallucination. I was going to go farther and tell him about Rochester jumping back after the shooting at Stick's apartment, but at that moment Bowden put his head into the corridor and asked us to come in. Mr. Rumplunkett had finished his initial examination.
One shot through the heart, very clean, very professional. Everything about the body otherwise normal, except evidence of rickets in childhood. It's quite rare these days, so it shouldn't be difficult to trace, unless, of course, he spent his youth in another country. Very poor dental work and lice. It's probable he hasn't had a bath for at least a month. There is not a lot I can tell you, except his last meal was suet, mutton and ale. There'll be more when the tissue samples come back from the lab.
Victor and I exchanged looks. I was correct. The corpse had to be Mr. Quaverley's. We all left hurriedly. I explained to Bowden who Quaverley was and where he came from.
I don't get it, said Bowden as we walked towards the car. How did Hades take Mr. Quaverley out of every copy of Chuzzlewit?
Because he went for the original manuscript, I answered, for the maximum disruption. All copies anywhere on the planet, in whatever form, originate from that first act of creation. When the original changes, all the others have to change too. If you could go back 100 million years and change the genetic code of the first mammal, every one of us would be completely different. It amounts to the same thing.
Okay, said Bowden slowly, but why is Hades doing this? If it was extortion, why kill Quaverley?
I shrugged. Perhaps it was a warning. Perhaps he has other plans. There are far bigger fish than Mr. Quaverley and Martin Chuzzlewit.
Then why isn't he telling us?
Chapter 21. Hades and Goliath. All my life I have felt destiny tugging at my sleeve. Few of us have any real idea what it is we are here to do and when it is that we are to do it. Every small act has a knock-on consequence that goes on to affect those about us in unseen ways. I was lucky that I had so clear a purpose. Thursday next, a life in Specops. But he was. When we got back, a letter was waiting for me at the station. I had hoped it was from Landon, but it wasn't. It bore no stamp and had been left on the desk that morning. No one had seen who delivered it. I called Victor over as soon as I had read it, laying the sheet of paper on my desk to avoid touching it any more than I had to. Victor put his spectacles on and read the note aloud. Dear Thursday, when I heard you had joined the Literatech staff, I almost believed in divine intervention. It seems that we will at last be able to sort out our differences. Mr. Quaverley was just for starters. Martin Chuzzlewit himself is next for the axe, unless I get the following. £10 million in used notes, a Gainsborough, preferably the one with the boy in blue, an 8-week run of Macbeth for my friend Thomas Hobbs at the Old Vic, and I want you to rename a motorway services Lee Delamere after the mother of an associate. Signal your readiness by a small ad in the Wednesday edition of the Swindon Globe announcing Angora rabbits for sale, and I will give you further instructions. Victor sat down.
It signed Acheron. Imagine, Martin Chuzzlewit without Chuzzlewit, he exclaimed earnestly, running through all the possibilities. The book would end within a chapter. Can you imagine the other characters sitting around, waiting for a lead character who never appears? It would be like trying to stage Hamlet without the prince.
So, what do we do? Asked Bowden.
Unless you have a Gainsborough you don't want and £10 million in loose change, we take this to Braxton.
Jack Shit was in Braxton Hicks' office when we entered. He didn't offer to leave when we told Hicks it was important, and Hicks didn't ask him to.
So, what's up?
Asked Braxton, glancing at Shit, who was practicing his putting on the carpet. Hades is alive, I told him, staring at Jack Shit, who raised an eyebrow.
Goodness, muttered Shit in an unconvincing tone. That is a surprise.
We ignored him.
Read this, said Victor,
handing across Acheron's note in a cellophane wrapper. Braxton read it before passing it to Shit.
Place the ad office next, said Braxton loftily. You seem to have impressed Acheron enough for him to trust you. I'll speak to my superiors about his demands, and you can inform me when he contacts you again.
He stood up to let us know that But I stayed seated.
What's going on, sir?
Classified next. We'd like you to make the drop for us, but that's the only way you can be involved in the operation. Mr. Shit has an extremely well-trained squad behind him who will take care of Hades' capture. Good day.
Still, I didn't rise.
You're going to have to tell me more, sir. My uncle is involved, and if you want me to play ball, I'm going to have to know what's happening.
Braxton Hicks looked at me and narrowed his eyes.
I'm afraid...
What the hell? Interjected Shit. Tell him.
Braxton looked at Shit, who continued to practice his putting.
You may have the honour, Shit, said Braxton angrily. It's your show, after all.
Over the last 100 years, there has been an inexplicable cross-fertilisation between works of fiction and reality. We know that Mr. Analogy has been investigating the phenomenon for some time, and we know about Mr. Glubb and several other characters who have crossed into books. We knew of no one to have returned, so we considered it a one-way journey. Christopher Sly changed all that for us.
You have him? Asked Victor. No, he went back. Quite of his own accord, although unfortunately because he was so drunk, he went back not to Will's version of The Taming of the Shrew, but to an uneven rendition in one of the bad quartos. Melted into thin air one day while under observation.
He paused for effect and polished his putter with a large red-spotted handkerchief.
For some time now, the Goliath Advanced Weapons Division has been working on a device that will open a door into a work of fiction. After